everyone, and welcome to Mindshift, the podcast that's all about helping you to think critically about things like God, the church, and spirituality. I'm sitting here today from The Rock here in North Wales with a good glass of Welsh-made blackberry wine, and I thought, you know what? What better to do today than to do a podcast about the Puritans and about Jonathan Edwards and the story of his famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Now, why am I doing a story of Jonathan Edwards? Why am I talking about the Puritans and the sermon Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God? You may have never heard of Jonathan Edwards. You may know who the Puritans were or think you know, but the fact is, it's important to understand the context behind things and how you and I have been affected by events in the past or decisions that people have made in the past that have reverberations down through the centuries, even though we may not be directly aware of them. But I can almost guarantee you that in some way, shape, or form, you have been affected by either Jonathan Edwards, his famous sermon, and perhaps the Puritans as well, especially if you're American. It doesn't really matter if you're a Christian or not. In some way, shape, or form, you've been affected by these people, these movements. If you've ever had someone try to evangelize you, try to proselytize you into the Christian faith, or you've heard a hellfire and brimstone style sermon, and the whole construct of the whole thing was about you being convicted that you're a sinner, judged guilty in the eyes of God, and that you are destined or doomed for the flames of eternal fire in hell. Now, that person trying to proselytize you wouldn't, of course, leave you hanging there. He or she would have said, now, there's good news as well. The fact that you're bound for hell isn't the end of the story. The good news in all of this, that Christian person will tell you, is that Jesus Christ died on the cross for you, and there's a way out of going to hell, and in fact, you can go to heaven. If you've ever been a part of a revival, or you've been invited to a sort of revival meeting, whether it was a Billy Graham crusade, Luis Palau, one of these famous guys that preach, that's the tradition of Jonathan Edwards and the Great Awakening revival in the 18th century. He was a big part of launching that revival. In fact, it's interesting because I used to teach in Leeds quite a bit in England, and a lot of the students, in fact, all the students when I taught there, they were all from Africa. And I can guarantee you that each and every one of them was affected by a person like Jonathan Edwards, people like the Puritans. They were affected by the modern-day missions movement. If you know anything about the missions movement in the 18th and 19th centuries, it was closely tied to colonialism. And of course, Africans were recipients of a lot of American and European missionaries that went across, and they were part of this sort of revivalistic missional movement that was started by people like Jonathan Edwards. And in fact, it's very interesting when I used to talk to my students in Leeds, all these Africans, and I would ask them about their theology, it was very much a Calvinist, fundamentalist type of doctrine that they had, and that was because the missionaries that they'd been taught by were, of course, mostly Americans or Europeans. They were Brits who had come across to Africa, and so the theology they were bringing back over to Great Britain was very much a fundamentalist, or either that, or it was a very Pentecostal, charismatic type of theology. And so we can see the impact, the effect of people like Jonathan Edwards, people like the Puritans, who definitely have a lasting impact, for example, as I say, on the nation of America, the whole thing about covenant theology, America being a chosen nation, blessed by God and all that. And I'll get a little bit more into that in this episode. So this is kind of a preview of what I want to talk about in this podcast today, the story of the Puritans, the story specifically of the life of Jonathan Edwards, and exploring how does a guy like Jonathan Edwards, who was raised in a Puritan Calvinist context in 18th century New England, how does he come to preach a hellfire and brimstone type of sermon like Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God? And how does this sermon and the effect of the Great Awakening that Edwards helped to launch, along with other people like George Whitefield and other revivalists, how does that still with us today? The fact that we are talking about a guy like that and one particular sermon that was preached 276 years ago. And in fact, there came a book recently by Brian Zahn called Sinners in the Hands of a Loving God, which of course is obviously a riff on Jonathan Edwards' famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. So the fact that this residue of this kind of theology and teaching is still with us today is astounding. One sermon, one life has made a huge difference that still comes down through the centuries. And so in this episode, I'm going to get into a little bit of the historical context, where the Puritans came from. If you know anything about history, if you don't, you might find that interesting. Where did the Puritans come from? Who were they? And specifically, let's pick up the story of the life of Jonathan Edwards. I want to take you through the experiences that he went through and some of the toxic theology, some of the Calvinist theology that he was attempting to live out as a young man, and how that affected his mental health and how that contributed hugely to him finally preaching that sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, in 1741. So stay tuned for the story of the Puritans, Jonathan Edwards, and Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Just a couple of things before we get into this story today. I want to give a shout out to a couple of people who have recently sponsored Mindshift on Patreon. My sister Valerie Cunningham, who was on this show just last week telling her story of growing up in a fundamentalist home under the teachings of Bill Gothard. And if you haven't heard that episode, that is a very powerful, moving story. And also Ray Guilford, who has also pledged to support Mindshift on Patreon. And both of them have just recently joined the Mindshift podcast group on Facebook. And you can be a part of that too. If you have found the work of Mindshift helpful at all or challenging to you, you can go to patreon.com/preachersforum, which is the name that I used to call this podcast. It used to be the Preachers Forum podcast, but I've recently changed it to Mindshift because it seemed to reflect more of what I was doing in this area of critical thinking and helping people to have a mind shift from what they think they knew, what they think they believed, and questioning some of the presuppositions. And so this is what this show is all about. I'll also talk at the end of the show how you can get a hold of me on social media. You can follow me on Twitter as well as Instagram. And in fact, I'm thinking that Instagram's a good way if you want to kind of get to know a little bit about me and some of the places that I travel to. My wife Lisa and I, we love to travel all over England and Europe, and I frequently post a lot of pictures from the places that we travel. So check me out on Instagram at Preachers Forum. And I'll talk a little bit more about that at the end of the show as well, other contact details. All right, so without further ado, let's go on and get into the story of Jonathan Edwards. Who was Jonathan Edwards? What was he all about? Well, he was born in October of 1703, and he died in March of 1758. And what is his enduring legacy? As I said, he's best known for preaching his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. He actually preached it twice. First of all, he preached it at his home church, which was in Northampton, Massachusetts. But you know what? Nothing really happened there. Then he was invited to preach it again in Enfield, Connecticut in 1741. In fact, it's funny. There's a monument in Enfield, Connecticut. It's a big stone that commemorates the location where that sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, was preached. And as I say, this is probably his best known and most enduring legacy, is this sermon that he preached in 1741. And actually, it's a funny thing when you look at his whole life story, this is not the kind of sermon that he normally preached. This was not his normal sort of standard fare week in and week out. He was a pastor for nearly 30 years in Northampton until he was finally unceremoniously booted out of his church. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. How did he get fired from his job? But he did. He got sacked from his job after being there nearly 30 years at Northampton in this church. So any preacher, any pastor who's ever been sacked from their church job maybe can identify a little bit with what happened to Jonathan Edwards. All right, so let's think about this for a minute. Jonathan Edwards, as I say, was born in the early part of the 18th century. He was born in 1703. He's born into a Puritan context. So who were the Puritans? At this point, you might be thinking that the Puritans are the same thing as the Pilgrims, you know, the ones who came across from England on the Mayflower and settled in New England in 1620. But the two groups are not the same thing. The Puritans were part of that group that we call the Pilgrims. Okay, so who were the Puritans? Well, the Puritans come out of England, and they are part of the Church of England. Now, where does the Church of England come from? If you know your history at all, you'll know that on the continent in the 16th century, Luther, of course, started the Protestant Reformation. And it all started when he nailed his 95 Theses to the door of the church in Wittenberg, which is now modern-day Germany, in 1517. And this, of course, launched, as we know, the Protestant Reformation. And we see great characters coming out of this movement, like, of course, Martin Luther himself and John Calvin in Geneva and Zwingli and the Anabaptists and all these other sort of denominations that come out of the Protestant Reformation. But what's going on in England? Well, England was a staunchly Catholic nation. Their king, who was on the throne at the time, was King Henry VIII. Yes, this is the same King Henry VIII that had six wives. And you may remember him from that famous little song that talks about the fact that some of his wives were beheaded and some of them survived. But King Henry, believe it or not, was no mean theologian himself. He was a staunch Catholic, and he wrote a book in 1521 entitled The Defense of the Seven Sacraments. And basically what he was saying is that this was a staunch defense of the Pope. It was an attack on the heresies of Martin Luther's and all the rest of it. And this was such a important work that Pope Leo X in 1521 gave Henry VIII the title of the Defender of the Faith. So King Henry is a good, staunch Catholic, loyal defender of the Pope and good Catholic theology. But of course, if you know your history at all, you know that Henry began to have a problem. He was married to his first wife, Catherine of Aragon. Unfortunately, she was unable to have children. And for Henry, as is always the case, political expediency ends up trumping whatever religious ideals he may have had. He needed a male heir, so when he died, the kingdom would not be plunged into civil war or something like that. So he ended up trying to get a divorce from his first wife from the Pope. And if you know the story, the Pope refused, which of course is against good Catholic doctrine, good Catholic theology. Divorce is not allowed. So King Henry ended up splitting from the Catholic Church. As I say, political expediency won out over his principles or his religious convictions, and so he ends up splitting from the Catholic Church and forming the Church of England, or the Anglican Church, which of course conveniently turned around and gave Henry the permission to divorce his wife and marry the next one. And on it goes, all the way through to number six, at which point Henry ends up dying. Now, despite Henry VIII being excommunicated by the Pope Clement, the bishops of the newly formed Anglican Church still voted him as the defender of the faith. And of course, it was the Anglican, or Church of England, version of the faith. So where do the Puritans come from in all of this? Well, in order to understand the story, you have to understand that the successive monarchs that came after Henry VIII really determined the fate of not only the country, the direction of the country in terms of its own theology and religious direction, but of course, the context of those who found themselves on the wrong side of that particular monarch. Ironically, though, even though Henry VIII did have a son, he didn't reign very long. He was only 15 when he died, and this is King Edward VII. Now you have Mary Tudor, who is the daughter of Henry VIII. She reigns for a while, and she's more Catholic. She wants to steer England back toward Catholic values, and so the Protestants are persecuted, and thus she earns the nickname Bloody Mary. And sort of this is how it goes. As the next monarch comes and goes, whether it's a king or a queen, it depends on whether or not he or she is more of a Catholic or a Protestant. And the Catholics may be persecuted or the Protestants may be persecuted. And this is sort of the context in Great Britain for the next, well, almost 100 years, till you get to Charles I. And then, of course, the English Civil War, which begins in 1642. And this pitted the Parliament, which had a lot of Puritans in it, against King Charles I. Now, these Puritans were those within the Church of England who felt like there were too many Catholic influences creeping in. They wanted to purify the Church of England, and this is basically where the nickname Puritans come from. And around about 12 years before the English Civil War began, in the year 1630, a lot of these Puritans had gotten tired of being persecuted. They were in the minority, and they called it the Great Migration. From 1630 to 1641, some 21,000 Puritans left England and came across to the colonies, to the American colonies, for religious freedom. And so this is where the Puritans come from, sort of their historical context, and how so many of them end up in New England and settling there. So let's talk for a minute about what the Puritans believed. Well, they were staunch Calvinists. And you look at some of the tenets of Calvinism. This is, of course, the teaching that comes from John Calvin. He was one of the prominent leaders of the Reformation. He was born in France, but he ended up living in Geneva and preaching there. And some of the core doctrines, things like God's sovereignty determines the will of a person, the predestination of God, that is the pre-selection of God, even before a person is born, he is predetermining who will go to heaven and who will go to hell. And in the truest Calvinist sense, God wants only the salvation of those who are the elect, those who have been predestined, and he provides grace only to those elect, because those that are non-elect are obviously going to hell. They are not going to heaven. And in a truly Reformed Calvinist understanding, they would say that Christ died only for those elect, only for those chosen to go to heaven. This is called limited atonement. And of course, if you have God choosing some for heaven, then God must, by logical conclusion, predetermine some others for hell. And therefore, the elect are absolutely assured of their salvation. Well, the Puritans took to this theology. They liked it because it matched their beliefs. It matched their desire to purify the Church of England, which, of course, a lot of them were fleeing to come to the colonies for religious freedom. And they wanted to focus on the Bible. They wanted to focus on Calvinism as a theology. And you can see how it influenced their lifestyle. Okay, so we know that they were Calvinists in their basic theology. What did they actually believe? Well, they believe that religion is a very personal, inner experience. They believe also, as good Calvinists do, that humans are sinful by nature. That is total depravity. But a chosen few can be saved by the grace of God. And those, of course, are the elect, those who have been predestined for salvation. And here's an interesting thing that I think we still see in North America today. They believe that hard work, worldly success, monetary success are signs of God's grace and God's blessing on a person. So how do you escape an eternity in hell if you're a good Calvinist Puritan? Well, of course, this is by God's grace, his special favor. Now, this brings about a very interesting theological conundrum and a serious problem if you are a Puritan. And that is, how do you know for certain if you are one of the elect? How do you know that you have had the grace? Could you feel it? And they believed, well, as an intense emotion, yes, we could feel that arrival of the grace. So people that who had that grace, who had that intense emotion, were for sure among the elect. That is, they were truly saved and they were on their way to heaven. They had been chosen by God. But people who didn't have that grace were among the unregenerate. They were damned. They were not saved and they were going to hell. Now let's take a minute and break this down. How can you know if a person has truly been saved and they have been the recipient of that grace? Well, they argued that you could be seen by your outward behavior. So if you had grace, if you were truly one of the elect, you displayed things like self-reliance, personal responsibility, industriousness, that so-called Calvinist or Puritan work ethic. You had a life of temperance. You lived a life of simplicity. Okay, so hopefully there were some ways by which a person could know for sure if they were saved, if they were among the elect who were indeed going to heaven. So this is some of the Calvinist influences on the theology of the Puritans. But there's more to this story as well as we begin to unpack the legacy of the Puritans on American culture and American religion. John Winthrop, one of the early leaders of the Puritans who came across from England, he made a famous speech in which he said, these Puritan settlers in the colony were going to form a society that was like a city on a hill. And that was his famous image. And of course, this phrase has been used in presidential speeches. Even John F. Kennedy, as well as Ronald Reagan, in their speeches made use of that phrase. And what were they referring to? Well, this is the idea of classic covenant theology. In other words, as the Puritans came from England across to the American colonies, the way they read the Bible, and specifically the Old Testament, they believed that they were sort of the replacement for Israel, that the church of their day, of which they were, of course, the true church, they had essentially replaced the nation of Israel in terms of a covenant with God. Not only did God make covenants with individual people like Abraham and Noah and David, but he also made covenants with entire nations. And of course, we see that he makes covenants with the nation of Israel in the Old Testament. Well, the Puritans believed that their society was a covenant society in which God himself had made a covenant with them. And like the ancient Israelites fleeing Egypt for the promised land of what's now today Israel or the land of Canaan, they saw themselves coming across to America, escaping religious persecution, and coming to the promised land of America, the American colonies, for a great society, this image of a city on a hill that will not only serve as a beacon of hope to those who see it and who want to come experience it, but there's this sense of mission. And out of this comes, even today, a great sense that America is this sort of religious land of freedom, a Christian nation in air quotes, and that a lot of the modern missions movement comes out of this sort of covenant theology, as well as the idea that goes along with the covenant. Now, the Puritans believed that if they were a just and righteous and holy society, sort of like living under the legal code of the Old Testament law, they would be blessed by God, as ancient Israel was under the terms of that covenant. Now, if they started to sin and slip as a society and fall into sin and drunkenness and all these other terrible sins, well, what would happen? God was going to curse them and punish them as a society and ultimately as a nation. And that is basically how this thing works. In other words, if the Puritans would uphold the covenant with God, well, God's going to reward them. And part of the blessing is that he was going to make them an example for the world. But, as I've said, if the colonists broke that covenant, well, God's going to unleash his wrath on the entire community. And as we see, this is still very much with us today. Talk about the legacy of Puritanism, as well as this notion of being a covenant nation. One of the most famous examples is on the day after 9/11, on the 12th of September. There's a clip, you can probably find this on YouTube even now, where Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, two fundamentalist Christian preachers, they are on the 700 Club. And the hosts of the 700 Club asked them both, why did 9/11 happen? Why were these attacks on the Twin Towers? What was that all about? And Jerry Falwell famously said, God will not be mocked. He said, I blame the abortionists, the gays, the lesbians. I blame the liberals, he said, for taking prayer out of public schools. So God will not be mocked. It is very much seen as judgment upon the entire nation for our corporate sins by allowing homosexuality and abortion and all these other terrible sins in Falwell's view. And you can see this even today, the recent natural disasters that America has experienced, like the floods in Houston and the various hurricanes and natural disasters, forest fires in the Northwest. There's always some famous preacher, for example, like Jim Baker, who will stand up on their show and say, these natural disasters are occurring as God's judgment on America for our corporate sins. So this legacy of Puritan theology, good old Calvinist covenant theology, are still very much with us today in terms of public discourse and the way that many people sort of interpret this idea of God blessing America. What does that mean? And God's judgment on America for our sins. So we see that it's very much still with us even to this day. All right, now we've kind of set the historical context for the Puritans. You can imagine then, perhaps, what kind of a world was Jonathan Edwards born into? As I say, he was born in 1703. Now, he was the son of one Timothy Edwards. Who was Timothy Edwards? Well, he was a minister, and he was the pastor of a church in East Windsor, Connecticut. And strangely enough, it's now South Windsor. I'm not sure how that exactly happened, but that's the way it is now. Now, Jonathan is the fifth one that's born of 11 children total. All the rest of them are girls. So he's got older sisters and younger sisters, but he's the only son. Now, another interesting thing is, not only did he grow up listening to the sermons of his father, Timothy, of course, he had to go to church every Sunday because that was part of Puritan society. It was illegal to miss church. If you skipped church too many times, you could actually be fined and end up in legal trouble. So not only is he growing up listening to the sermons of his father, his mother's father, Solomon Stoddard, was a towering figure. He was also a pastor in Northampton, Massachusetts. So young Jonathan has got two preachers that figure prominently in his life. He grows up listening to sermons. He grows up like most Puritan kids did. You learn to read by reading the Bible. So he grows up in a context, sort of, you could say, steeped in piety. You know, he's preaching sermons even to his sisters when he's a young boy. They would go out and he would preach these sermons as a young kid. So he really felt like he had this sort of calling, you might say, on his life to be a preacher. But as I've talked about with Mark Shelsky and Steve Austin, the effects of toxic or bad theology can really mess a person up. And our young Jonathan falls victim to some of the problems that are inherent within this Calvinist sort of context. Okay, so what's the problem? Well, to become a member of a church in that day, you had to produce a testimony. Not just any testimony, it had to be kind of a scripted testimony. You had to have a sort of convincing before and after story. In order to be accepted as a member of one of these churches, and it was part of such a part of the culture that you really had to be part of the church, you had to produce, you know, the story of when you were a reprobate sinner before you found God, or maybe in their theology, before God found you. And so you had this moment of, you know, intense conviction. Maybe it was the laws of God. Maybe you realized that you were a terrible sinner and that you had broken God's laws and that you were justly condemned to the flames of hell. But there came a moment out of this conviction that you realized your need for salvation and you accepted Christ. You became a genuine convert, thus, of course, proving that you were one of the elect. And that was your story. And if you could produce that sort of conversion narrative, you were judged and you lived a good life. You were judged worthy of becoming a member of the church. Now, what's the problem with that? As we see, this legacy is even still with us today, this idea of producing a convincing testimony. What's the problem, though, with producing a testimony? Well, you see, as the generations of Puritans grow up in the American colonies, like our young Jonathan Edwards, they're raised in a context of piety. Now, the Puritans who came from England, or the first or second generation, they could perhaps produce this conversion narrative where they could say, yes, I was a terrible sinner, then I became a good Christian. But Jonathan could not produce that story. As far as he knew, he'd always grown up loving God. He'd grown up reading the Bible. He'd grown up in church. He'd grown up listening to sermons and even preaching them himself to his poor sisters who had to sit through his maybe terrible sermons when he was a young boy. I don't know how good they were. But he couldn't produce that narrative. And this became a huge problem that racked his mind and tore at his soul. His eternal destiny was at stake, and yet he could not produce a convincing, transformative narrative of that before and after story. As far as he knew, he'd always been a believer in God and had always loved God. Now this tore him apart. And again, we have to put Jonathan Edwards within his historical context. In George Marsden's book, A Short Life of Jonathan Edwards, he says that Jonathan Edwards, he grows up in this Calvinist New England, this Puritan context. He was surrounded by the teaching that above all else, says Marsden, quote, nothing mattered nearly as much as the state of one's soul. Eternity was at stake. Those who served self and success alone would be condemned to suffer miserably in hell for eternity, as the Bible thought. The catch was that in Calvinist New England, says Marsden, no amount of effort could earn heaven. Salvation was by God's grace alone. For strict Protestants like Calvinists, this was the most basic principle that separated them from Catholics, end quote, as well as the Arminians. Now you can see the problem. No amount of learning, no amount of striving could create a heart that truly loved God, says Marsden. The more you sin, it only hardened your heart further away from God. Now, if you cultivated godly habits like reading your Bible and praying, of course, they didn't earn a person's salvation. But critically, they believed that those kind of pious actions could prepare your heart to be open to the grace of God, maybe clear out some of the obstacles that are in the way to salvation. So Edwards grows up in this context. He's practicing good works. He's strictly disciplined. He's reading his Bible. He understands the law of God. He understands piety, but he's growing up. He doesn't feel like he's exhibiting that true heartfelt love for God despite his piety. So what happens? At the young age of 13, he goes off to Yale University, where he's exposed to the current thinkers of his day, the Enlightenment thinkers like Locke and Newton and some of these other things. And this kind of jars his world because some of these people have already rejected the very tenets of Calvinism to which he is clinging. And he's putting his eternal destiny on the line here. This is critically important stuff for Edwards. Now, we talk about the effects of toxic theology. Look at what happens to Edwards. He goes off to Yale at 13. He has a very serious illness. He nearly dies. Following his recovery, he has what he believes is a true conversion experience. But you know what? That experience did not seem to take. He struggles. He tries even harder at self-improvement, all in vain. Now, I can identify with Jonathan Edwards. I was baptized not once, not twice, but three times. And my conversion experiences never seemed to take either. I was the victim of bad theology. But then, after all these things happened to Edwards, he's really racking his brain. He's really thinking. And you know what? He has kind of a breakthrough moment. He has all these objections to the sovereignty of God. Some are elected for heaven. Some are elected for hell. He's really struggling. Am I one of the elect, or am I just a self-deluded fool? Am I just trying to fool myself into believing that I really love God and I'm going to heaven? So what happened in this breakthrough for Edward? Well, he has this sort of revelation. He thinks to himself, you know what? Maybe the problem is I've been underestimating the sovereignty of God rather than overestimating it. And perhaps this idea that I need to start with a personal God, a sovereign God, who's expressing himself, says Marsden, in the ever-changing relationships of every atom to each other. And this blows his mind. He says, wait a minute, I'm starting to have these dramatic experiences. They're more recognizably spiritual, and it's kind of a spiritual and intellectual breakthrough. He begins to have these life-changing emotional encounters with the beauty of God. So he goes out into nature, and he starts to see that everything in creation is actually pointing to the attributes of God. God is trying to communicate to humanity, and he's showing the love of God and the love of Christ through everything in creation. You think, okay, this is great. Young Edwards, away at Yale, has had a great breakthrough. It's all made sense to him now. But you know what? That didn't actually solve his problem. Rather than being relieved at this emotional and spiritual breakthrough, the problem is he realizes, you know what, my conversion experience still doesn't seem to fit into this sudden transformation in which I can name the day, the hour, the exact moment when I was converted. And he starts to worry, maybe the process that I've been going through, maybe it didn't seem to follow those exact steps, those kind of pilgrim's progress steps that people in the past had identified this transition from being some sort of truly depraved, reprobate sinner into now being a true saved Christian. So what does he do? Well, again, the effects of bad or toxic theology. He goes on continuing, as he says, great and violent inward struggles. What is he trying to do? He's trying to purge his faults. He's trying to prove that his transformation was truly genuine, that he was indeed saved. And again, you can see this sort of thinking perhaps in these accountability groups that people get involved in, because this is sort of the thing that happens to Edwards. He gets a gig as a sort of interim pastor in New York City. It's a little Presbyterian church. He's only there for 8 months, from 1722 to 1723. And they liked him there. They thought he was a good preacher. He was sort of a pulpit supply. But you know what? He's still racked with this problem. In New York, he writes what he calls a set of resolutions. These are resolutions that he's supposed to follow every single day. He even keeps a diary, and he tracks his efforts every day to follow them. He's still trying to prove that this conversion, this transformation, was indeed genuine. And over the next couple of years, even after he left the church in New York City and came back home, he is still trying for the next several years He has many highs, and then he has many lows. He either succeeds or he fails in keeping his resolutions. And he calls them these melancholy periods when he's in the lows, when he isn't succeeding. He's not living up to the expectations that he's putting on himself. Even we might say today he's suffering from some form of mild depression. And as I say, maybe this is a lot of the thinking behind what we call these accountability groups. Okay, maybe there's some good thinking behind it. But I think a lot of people are trying to hold themselves accountable, if nothing else, to prove, like Jonathan Edwards was trying to prove, that they are genuinely a truly saved and transformed Christian. Now you got to start keeping the rules. Now you have all these resolutions. How many times a week or a day do you have to read your Bible and pray? And what is the ultimate outcome of, you know, having someone hold your feet to the fire? I can remember when I was a Bible college student, when I was a pastor, I was in various accountability groups, and in a way, I always felt like they were a recipe for disaster because I never ever succeeded like Jonathan Edwards didn't succeed in keeping all these resolutions. And I always ended up feeling like a failure, and I always wondered, okay, God, what's wrong with me? How come I'm not living up to these expectations that I put on myself? Even though I never seemed to find in Scripture that this was supposed to be the ideal that we as Christians are supposed to live up to. This is a system which can easily devolve into a legalistic system that people place on other Christians within churches so much of the time. Now, the critical thing to understand about Jonathan Edwards and ultimately the sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, that we're going to get to in a few minutes, is that everything in his life is really shaped by these early experiences that he has as a young man. You can see how he's struggling with his Calvinist theology. Am I truly one of the elect? I don't feel a sense of love for God. I can't come up with a conversion narrative. I can't come up with this sort of, you know, testimony that talks about how terrible I was before. And then I had this breakthrough moment, the shining light that God came upon me and boom, I was a Christian. And now my life is completely different and completely transformed. So he's wrestling with these issues because, of course, his own personal experience doesn't match the traditional understanding in this Puritan context. All right, so let's pick up his story again. The year 1727, that's a big year for Jonathan Edwards because two things happened there in the year 1727. First of all, he gets a gig at Northampton. All right, now this is the church where his grandfather, as I mentioned before, Solomon Stoddard, is the head pastor. He's the senior pastor. He's the minister. And this is a big deal because Northampton, the church where his grandfather was the head minister, was one of the most affluent and large congregations in New England. And this was an extremely prestigious position. Okay, so he gets a gig as the associate pastor for his grandfather. The second thing that happens in that year is he gets married. His wife, Sarah Pierpont, she's only 17. So they're just young kids when they get married. Now everything's going great. And in his new job at Northampton, the associate pastor. But just 2 years later, Solomon Stoddard in 1729 suddenly dies. What happens? His grandson, Jonathan Edwards, the young man fresh out of college, gets the job of the sole head minister of one of the largest, one of the most wealthy congregations in the colony. It is proud of its morality. It's proud of its reputation, proud of its culture. So here's Edwards. He gets the difficult job of the head pastor of his grandfather's church. Now, anyone who's ever taken over as pastor of a church when the person before you was a very respected figure, a very charismatic leader, a great preacher, a great communicator, and you have to step into his or her shoes, you know how difficult this can be, especially as a young man. So Edwards has got to fit within this groove. He's got to sort of, you know, placate the expectations of these congregation members here in Northampton. He can't stray too far out of the normal groove or the rut, we might say, of the sermons that his grandfather used to preach pretty much week in and week out. Now, as we said before, Edwards has a sort of an existential problem. Part of the problem is that his own conversion experience, his own life story, didn't really fit the same one that his grandfather and his minister father demanded of people who wanted to become members of these congregations. So what's Jonathan Edwards supposed to say? Well, when you look at the early sermons that Jonathan Edwards preaches in Northampton, a lot of them are actually emphasizing the beauty, the purity, the love of God. He's not really preaching hellfire and brimstone damnation sermons. Remember that Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God was preached in 1741, and he gets the gig as the head minister in 1729. So a lot of years are going to pass before he gets to Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. But of course, he's trapped, isn't he? He's stuck between a rock and a hard place. His own conversion experience doesn't really seem to fit, but yet he's got these sort of rigid constraints that he's got to operate in terms of expectations and the legacy of his own grandfather, Solomon Stoddard. And I can't imagine being in that place. It's a tough place that he must have been in. He struggled with this issue of salvation since his own experience didn't fit the typical formula. And on this, in an article on Jonathan Edwards, Yarbrough and Adams, they comment that, quote, unable to question further his own election, Edwards begins to question the morphology that put his conversion in doubt, end quote. In other words, the process, the morphology. And you got to understand his early sermon rhetoric. In other words, the sort of communication strategy that Jonathan Edwards made use of. And once again, going back to the article by Yarbrough and Adams, they comment that, quote, inducing legal fear, the terror of damnation, would not send the sinner further along in his journey. Accordingly, they say, Edwards concentrated his efforts less on the steps toward conversion and more on the meaning of conversion itself and its effects, end quote. Now, the problem with that is your effect that you're going to have on the listeners is very severely limited. Conversion isn't subject to persuasion in Edwards' worldview. In other words, if you're truly one of the elect, no amount of persuasion is going to convince you because it's not about being convinced. You're already one of the elect. And if you are predestined to hell, then there's, again, no amount of persuasion that's going to change the mind of God in the sovereignty of God and get him to change your status. You're going to hell. That's it. End of story. No amount of persuasion on the part of a preacher is going to make a blind bit of difference. All he could really do then, in his early preaching at least, is to try and provide the optimal conditions or the circumstances within which conversion might take place. But of course, if you've preached at a church for many, many years, you know that the congregation, they get bored of hearing your sermons. They get bored of hearing the same style of sermons week in and week out. And this is a common problem. And the problem that Edwards had with his congregation at Northampton was, in a sense, not that they were terribly bad people. In a way, they were almost too good. They were sort of like him. They had grown up, too, most of them, in this sort of context of piety. They're growing up in a Puritan society where you had to go to church, where you learned to read by reading the Bible when you were a small child. Biblical literacy was very high. People knew their theology. People knew their Bibles. And so, like him, they couldn't necessarily produce a before and after conversion story either. So he's got this congregation. They are sort of inured. They're in this groove of hearing sermons. They probably listened to his grandfather's preaching for years before he came along, and he just continues in that tradition. But of course, herein lies the problem. If you give the people what they want week in and week out, they're going to get bored and they're going to be not listening anymore. They can't hear you. So now he's a bit stuck. How am I going to break through to these people? What can I say that's going to kind of smash their worldview apart and maybe get them to question whether or not they are truly saved? He begins to come up with what he thinks is the answer. He begins to make use of a new type of sermon genre, one that his grandfather had made use of from time to time, and it was called the Terror Sermon. And this now is where we arrive at Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. He decides, I've got to break through to these people. I've got to get through to them. I've got to sort of shake them up, make them question whether or not they are just like self-deluded hypocrites like I thought I was, or are they truly one of the elect and they're on their way to heaven. And this is where he preaches Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And when he preaches it, in Northampton, in his own home church, it really doesn't have very much of an effect. But then he's invited a few months later to go to Enfield, Connecticut. And when he preaches Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God at this other church in Enfield, it has an unbelievable response on the part of the people. They are screaming. They are crying. They are throwing themselves on the floor. They are howling. He's constantly interrupted throughout his sermon, people saying, if what you're saying is true, what must I do to be saved? And he barely makes it through the sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And he's got these incredibly powerful images. Some of the images are, he talks about how a man holds a loathsome spider in his fingers over a fire. And if the man so decides, all he has to do is open his fingers and that poor spider will fall into the flames and be consumed. And he says, in the same way, God is holding you, the sinner, over the flames of hell. What's stopping him from opening up his fingers and dropping you screaming into the flaming fires of hell for an eternity? You must understand that it is only the grace of God. That is the only thing that is stopping him from opening up his fingers and dropping that sinner into the flames of hell. Another image that Edwards develops in the sermon is this idea of a man walking along on muddy, slippery ground. And if you've ever done that, of course, you know how easy it is to slip and fall. And he says that's just like this image of the sinner. You're walking along, you're actually on the pit of hell, and you don't know it. And you could easily slip and fall into the pit of hell. And the only thing stopping you from falling into that pit is the gracious hand of God. But he says, actually, the devil is ready to fall on you at any moment. All God has to do is withdraw his hand of protection, and Satan's gotcha. It's only the grace of God that stops that sinner from being dropped into hell or being let go and attacked by Satan at any moment's notice. Now, once the sermon actually concluded, we need to know, did it in fact achieve its rhetorical aims? Did it have the intended effect that Edwards was hoping it would have on his audience? Well, as I said, people are screaming and crying out when they hear him preaching this terrifying sermon. And what happens is, this is part of the launching of what's called the Great Awakening in North America, which ends up spreading across the pond. You have people like George Whitefield and other people, famous preachers, who hold huge outdoor rallies, revivalistic meetings, and they are preaching to crowds of thousands and then ultimately tens of thousands. And there's this huge Great Awakening revival that ends up spreading really all over the world and having a massive impact even today in the revivalist tradition. Now, while we can certainly see the effect that a sermon like Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God had in starting or helping to launch what's called the Great Awakening and the sort of revivalist tendency, which has always been a big part of evangelical Christianity, both in Great Britain here and in America. And there's another aspect to this revivalism that we need to talk about. We need to think critically about this. I don't know if you've been around Christians, or maybe you've said this yourself. You've been a part of the revivalist tendency. You know, I hear a lot of people say, we need to pray for revival. We need to have a revival. Something like what happened with Jonathan Edwards and the Great Awakening. And this has been a longer tradition, certainly in America, as well as here in Great Britain. As I say, people like George Whitefield, Charles Finney, Billy Graham, Luis Palau. In fact, anyone who has huge revivals, and I mentioned my African students in Leeds, and they, of course, had been impacted by huge revivals, people like Reinhard Bonnke, T.D. Jakes, and others. And I've heard people talk about this. Let's pray for revival. Let's hope that revival breaks out. But you know what strikes me is, it seems to be like a kind of a lazy way out. We don't have to get involved in our community. We shouldn't do anything for our community except pray for revival. And somehow, God will do all the heavy lifting. God will do all the work. Suddenly, revival's going to break out in our church or wherever it may be. And in fact, there have been some famous examples of these in the last few decades. In the 1970s, there was a revival at Asbury College in Kentucky, as well as one in the Solomon Islands. And of course, in 1994, there was a famous one that broke out at the Toronto Airport Vineyard Church, as well as other ones that have broken out in different places. But what's interesting about these revivals is, as I say, it seems to me that it's too easy. It's too easy to sit there and pray for revival and hope that God suddenly somehow breaks out, that the Holy Spirit just breaks out and all these amazing things start to happen and people just are attracted and convicted of their sins and all these other things. And that's the classic revivalist tendency or the revivalist formula. But why not just get involved in your community? There's nothing stopping you right now from helping the needy, the poor, the disenfranchised in your area. You don't need permission to help someone. You can change the world one life at a time, one person at a time, instead of spending time praying for revival and yet doing very little for your community or for others for that matter. Now let's also think about the message of quote-unquote evangelism that goes along with many of these revivals that we see breaking out. Let's think for a minute about the concept of what passes for evangelism, in air quotes. I think a lot of us have been affected by this sort of toxic theology, this sort of teaching that basically presents the gospel, again in air quotes, as this sort of dichotomy, this black and white thinking. First, you're a sinner. You need to be then convicted of your sin from the Bible and then offered the good news of salvation. And you think of things like the so-called Romans Road, for example, or the four spiritual laws. What they have to do to present such a gospel is to pull several verses out of their context from the book of Romans, for example, and then present them to the seeker or the sinner to convict him or her of their sin and offer them the good news of the gospel. And this is a time-honored tradition. This isn't something that's only been around since, you know, Youth for Christ or the right, religious right in America or the revivalist tendency even before the American Civil War. People like Charles Finney and others, this has been around since before the time of Edwards. Like I said, he made use of this so-called terror sermon genre in an attempt to get through to his hardened listeners who were bored and all the rest of it. And it's been a tradition within evangelicalism, within revivalism. We have to question it. Like I said, this podcast is all about thinking critically. And we have to think critically. Is this, in fact, the gospel? Does Jesus himself in the gospels present the good news, as it were, or the kingdom of God in this fashion? Does he batter people over the head with the fear of going to hell and then give them the good news that he's going to die on the cross? You don't even see that in the teachings of Jesus. And I think a lot of people today, even today, in the legacy of people like Jonathan Edwards and others, are still presenting this sort of black and white dichotomized gospel message. So is it really any wonder that both churches as well as individual Christians are needlessly offending people and turning them away from what might actually be some good news, whatever that may be, and just acting like jerks and telling people, hey, you're going to hell, but I've got the good news, kind of like a salesperson selling a product, and you've got to close the deal. And maybe the truth is Christians are just needlessly offending people and driving them away with this kind of in-your-face black-and-white gospel. Instead of building relationships with people, earning the right to have those kind of conversations about what people believe, what people think. Because one of the legacies of this type of evangelism, again in air quotes, battering people over the head, trying to convict them of their sin, and then offering them the good news, first of all, it can needlessly offend people and drive people away from the message of Jesus, whatever that may be. And then secondly, as I say, is it mischaracterizing what the gospel actually is? And I'll leave that up to you to question for yourself. But you can see, once again, the legacy of a person like Edwards in that evangelical, evangelistic tradition. So ultimately, you can see Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, as preached by Jonathan Edwards in 1741, I think it really arises out of a pastoral concern on his part. But of course, as we all know, you can only sustain a revival for so long. You can only maintain some sort of fever pitch for so long. I mean, think about if you ever had an experience like mine and you used to go to Christian summer camp every year and you'd have these fabulous mountaintop spiritual experiences. You'd come back all fired up for God. But you can't live on mountaintop experiences. And as a preacher, Edwards could not sustain that level of revivalism for years and years and years. You just can't do it. And the problem that Edwards had as the years went by was that he was really concerned that the effects of this revival were going to last, that they really were going to take root in the people's hearts. And it's got to be the supreme height of irony that Edwards himself, who as a very young man had struggled with this very issue of whether or not his own conversion was in fact genuine, he now began to demand that of his own people. He began to worry that they were slipping back into their old lifestyle of sinfulness. And so what was his response to the problem? He started to get more strict on his people, and he started coming up with some rules and things that they needed to abide by. And in the end, he got embroiled in kind of a scandal over a book that some young people were looking at that had some pictures that they probably shouldn't have been looking at, in his view. And this was kind of the last straw. His people in Northampton had had enough of his kind of rigid and controlling behavior. And in the end, they booted him out. So they kicked him out after nearly 30 years of being their senior minister of this church in Northampton. And he ended up dying a few years later after he went off to be a missionary to the Native Americans. And then he died not many years after that. It's kind of a sad end for Jonathan Edwards in a way, that he's gone from this great sort of authoritative preacher who was really in on the ground floor of the first great awakening to, in the end, getting booted out of his own church that he was the pastor of for so many decades. But as I said at the beginning, we can see the legacy of Jonathan Edwards, the Puritans, and this sort of Calvinist theology that's very much with us even today. And if you've been affected by it, maybe you can sort of see your own story in the story of Jonathan Edwards, or perhaps see how it's affected others. In fact, I came across a post the other day in the Exvangelical Facebook page. And yeah, I did ask the person if I could read this comment. And this person was having a conversation with her mother about free will and homosexuality and whether or not people were born that way. And she finally concluded by saying, quote, "I don't want to change her, that is my mother, but I do want to say something that will make her think about this issue a little deeper. She has finally come to the decision that people are born that way, that is gay. Most of the time she will admit this. I have tried using other Bible verses with her to try and show that the Bible is not moral all the time, and she's actually said that she believes some people may be doomed to be slaves. She says this not as a racist, but due to Calvinist leanings. She's also the sort that thinks God saves some and dooms people with earthquakes and hurricanes and babies and kids die early for a reason, even if we don't know what it is. So we are at the mercy of her morality, being directed by the Bible instead of her own moral compass. The times she has found herself disagreeing with the Bible, she's in her bedroom, in tears, crying about it. What can I say?" Unquote. Now you think about that, and you think, okay, the legacy of Calvinism, the legacy of these Puritans who came across several hundred years ago, they've left a legacy behind. They absolutely have. And it's been taken to some strange and weird places for sure. We can certainly see it, as I pointed out, in the revivalist tendency. You know, great preachers like Billy Graham and Luis Palau, Greg Laurie, really any televangelist who holds some sort of mass revival rally, people that talk about praying for revival, people that talk about their particular interpretation of the Bible. Anytime you get into a discussion with somebody about predestination, election, whether or not some people are bound for hell, and that's been chosen by God, and apparently there's nothing they can do about it, there is no such thing as free will, and all the rest of it, you can point to a person like Jonathan Edwards and at least understand a little bit about his own context. You can see where he wrestled with some of these issues, how he tried to resolve it, and how he ends up preaching a sermon like Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, and the effect that even has resonating down through the centuries today. Well, I hope this has been a helpful discussion for you about Jonathan Edwards and the legacy of the Puritans and the sermon Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Hopefully understanding the historical context and the context of Jonathan Edwards has helped you a little bit perhaps understand. Maybe we can get a little bit of sympathy for Edwards. I'm not sure. If this conversation has been helpful or interesting to you at all, I would love to hear about it. As I say, you can contact me on a variety of ways in terms of social media. You can follow me on Twitter at Preachers Forum. You can also send me an email, preachersforum@gmail.com. You can look me up on Instagram as well, at Preachers Forum. I would also encourage you to have a look at the Preachers Forum blog. If you go to preachersforum.com, you'll see at the top menu there is a link to blog articles that I've written on a variety of subjects, my own experiences about leaving the church to find God, leaving the church to find myself. And so you never know, these might end up being helpful resources for you. And then finally, if you found the work of Mindshift helpful to you at all, you can consider supporting my work for as little as $1 a month. You can go to patreon.com/preachersforum and find out a little bit more information about why I'm doing what I'm doing, or at least trying to do it. It helps me pay for things like podcast hosting, website hosting, equipment, and all kinds of other things like travel, going up to Liverpool, Birmingham, different places around the country to interview people. And it helps me keep on doing what I'm doing here on Mindshift. Stay tuned next Friday for part one of Measuring the Metrics of Success with Sean Manley, who, along with his wife Cheryl, were recent guests of ours here on The Rock. And he tells his story of when he was a pastor of a church plant down in Palm Springs, California, and how that ended rather badly. And surprisingly, he's still within what I call the system, or as he calls it, the church. And so stay tuned for that interesting discussion that Sean and I had coming up next Friday. So once again, thank you for joining me here on Mindshift. This has been Dr. Clint Haycock taking a look at the Puritan legacy, Jonathan Edwards, and his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. I hope you join me next week once again for the next episode right here on Mindshift. Yes, they're changing.